Thank you. Well, this morning's a bit of a teaching process. Like I said, Dan opened up with apologetics last week, so we'll get on with apologetics is the discipline of defending a position, often religious, through the systematic use of information. The English word apology comes from the Greek word apologia, which basically means to give a defense. These are some things that Dan went over last week. Christian apologetics, then, is the science of giving a defense of the Christian faith. In ancient Athens, apologia referred to a process made in a courtroom, a defense in a courtroom, as part of the normal judicial procedure. After a defendant was charged with a crime, he was allowed to refute the charges with a defense or reply called apologia. The accused would attempt to speak away, apo, away, and logia, speech. Accusation, that's what he tried to do. The classic example of such apologia was Socrates' defense against the charge of preaching strange gods. Socrates' defense was told by his most famous student, Plato, and early Christian writers were defined, who defended their faith and against the critics and recommended their faith in charges, were called apologetics. And the thing that amazed me about this, that the classic example of apologia being Socrates, was what was he defending? He was defending his faith of gods back in Greece. So that applies to us. We are having there we go. In the classical Greek legal system, the prosecution, it would be the prosecuting attorney, deliver the, I can barely see it back there, but up here I can, the categoria, I forgot it for a minute. Sounds like category, doesn't it? The category of the charges. And the person replied with apologia. And we see apologia, or its verb form, this apologiomaia, it appears 17 times in the New Testament. I'm not going to go through all those verses. The bottom one isn't showing up there, but that's 1 Peter 3:15, and we went over that last week. The term apologetics in English language, as applied to religion, originated in 1733. Apologetics took on the meaning of intelligent presentation and defense, or major traditional, I can't see it back there, elements of faith. So I'm going to have a little bit of a struggle here, but we'll get through it. So it started in America, that word apologetics, to mean the way we define it now, in the early 1700s. And we know this in 1 Peter 3:15. This is the ESV. We've seen it last week in the NLT and the King James Version. But in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason, for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect. That's really important. In our early years, American Christians actively focused on apologetics. And this little painting here is from Washington Irving, and it's entitled Sunday Morning on Sleepy Hollow. And it kind of fits a little bit of the difference. You can see how they kind of went to church and how they went about things just in that photo or in that picture. But they practiced apologetics very early, and this is how they did it. One of the ways they did it, they began doing it with using the New England Primer. And here you see an example. And what I like about it a lot is they would apply scripture, they would apply doctrine in a rhyming manner. You know, Pastor Dan says, We know all this music, and we can memorize. We have it all memorized, but music's rhyming, and what they have here is pretty much the same thing. If you see at the very top on the right there, it says, "In Adam's fall, we sinned all. Next, the life to mend, this book will attend." And it starts to build up in us. It gives us strength. The cat does play, and after slay. He got the mouse. An eagle's flight is out of sight. And I kind of like the last one. An idle fool is whipped at school. So all these instructions were introduced in a rhyming way. And it was called the New England Primer. And here it is. It's a very large tome. We can hardly carry it around. But it's it was very important for 200 years, from 1690 up to 1890, or in the late 1800s, 1890. And it was a foundation for teaching. And some examples here. But our founding fathers raised on this work, often reprinted it to make sure that it was available for children in their generation. And here's some examples. Samuel Adams reprinted it for the students in Massachusetts. Benjamin Franklin reprinted it for the students in Pennsylvania, and Noah Webster reprinted it for the students in Connecticut. For over two centuries, the primer was the book for which American school children learned to read. And here are some example of 168 questions at the back of this book. You might be kind of surprised, but you've got to keep in mind, this was for elementary kids. What does Christ execute as our Redeemer? How does Christ execute the office of prophet? How does Christ execute the office of a priest? How does Christ execute the office of a king? These were questions that children were expected to answer. Our founding fathers were strong proponents of apologetics, and here is an example. Thomas Paine attacked the Bible in his famous book, The Age of Reason. In response, this fella, Elias Boudinot, who was president of Congress, a framer of the Bill of Rights, and the first attorney admitted to the U.S. Supreme Court bar, he was concerned that persons unacquainted with the apologetics might be damaged by Paine's attack. He therefore wrote his daughter, Susan, to make sure that she could withstand Paine's arguments and not waver in her beliefs. This is what he wrote. "It was not from a doubt of your principles being yet unsettled, or from apprehension that the extravagant and ludicrous ideas of the vain and infidel author of late publication entitled Age of Reason, that I have been led to show you its futility and weakness in the following sheets, but rather, knowing the importance of your being to be able to give a ready answer for the hope that is in you," 1 Peter 3:15. Boudinot believed that open-minded examination was the evidence easily provided the truth of the Bible. He explained, "God, in his infinite wisdom, has given us sufficient evidence that the revelation of the gospel is from him. This is subject to rational inquiry and of conviction from the nature of the evidence." Exactly what we're supposed to do. Founding Father John Wetherspoon, who was a signer of the Declaration of Independence and a noted theologian and president of Princeton College, similarly taught young people, "If the scripture is true, the discoveries of reason cannot be contrary to it, and therefore it has nothing to fear from that quarter. From reason, contemplation, sentiment, and tradition, the being and infant perfection and excellence of God may be deduced." Thomas Jefferson, the third president of the United States, agreed completely. In fact, he declared that the evidence for the being of God was so overwhelming that to argue the existence of God from a position solely of faith without resort to the proofs of reason actually hurt Christianity. He explained, "I think that every Christian sect," and that means denomination, "gives a great handle to atheism by their general dogma that without a revelation there would be not sufficient proof of the being of God. So irresistible are these evidence of an intelligent and powerful agent that the infinite numbers of men who have existed through all time, they have believed in the proportion of a million at least to a unit," that means a million to one, "in the hypothesis of an eternal pre-existent creator." Reverend Ezra Stiles was a conservative theologian, a president of Yale, and had served as chaplain during the American Revolution. Reverend Stiles acknowledged, "Religious liberty is peculiarly friendly to fair and generous discussion." You don't run into that word very often. That means systematic inquiry. "Here, deism will have its full chance, nor lead libertines," and we don't use that word very often. It means morally unrestrained individuals, "more to complain of being overcome by any weapons, but the general, the powerful ones of argument and truth. Revelation, the Bible, will be found to stand the test of the 10,000th examination." What did he say? He said that God doesn't need weapons. He only needs the gentle argument of truth, and that the Bible will last forever. Christians who know why they believe what they believe and who can defend their beliefs are able to do two things, which are the very context and purpose of 1 Peter 3:15. First, this is how we sanctify Christ, how we set him apart in our hearts, make him holy. And it strengthens our faith and our confidence. And second, giving a defense and a reason for the hope that is in us is how we extend that same hope to those who are asking. Embracing a value for apologetics empowers us to love God with our mind as well as our strength and our hearts. Apologetics. So unfortunately, though, apologetics sounds awfully close to apology, which today simply means I'm sorry. And I'm sorry is exactly opposite of a Christian apologetics. The problem with apologetics and defending Christianity is we tend to get into what is called in philosophy a circular argument. We use the Bible to defend the Bible. This makes perfect sense for us because we know what is true and see the truth in the Bible. To someone who has not heard the good news or rejects the good news, they do not have the Holy Spirit in their as their guide. They cannot see what is true without the Holy Spirit. So what's a circular argument? Well, here's an example of one. Girls like to chat when they're waiting in line because there's always a huge line because girls like to go to the bathroom together because girls like to chat. So you go around in a circle, and that affects the same thing with the Bible. But how can you be sure it's with the Word of God? Because the Bible tells us so. But why believe the Bible? The Bible is infallible. But how do you know it's infallible? The Bible is the Word of God. But how do you know? You see, it goes around and around. If you're not careful, you fall into these circular arguments that are not very effective. So how do you avoid the circular argument? Well, a couple different ways. One of them is circumstantial evidence. The circumstantial evidence is evidence. There are people who have been convicted to prison. There are people who have been executed on circumstantial evidence. And we have physical evidence. We're going to look at some of those today. Circumstantial evidence. Well, there's a good example with Pastor Robert Jeffers. This was during an Easter message he had. Two key pieces of evidence outside the Bible proving Jesus' resurrection. This is circumstantial evidence. One, people in the beginning were willing to die for his truth that Jesus was raised from the dead. We know that. It tells us in the Bible it's circumstantial. Jeffers said a key piece of evidence outside the Bible for the truth of resurrection, that's where I am with this, is the empty tomb. And that tells us in the Bible, and people reported it outside the Bible. Circumstantial evidence is evidence. And again, we fall into things like DNA and fingerprints. They may indicate you someone accused. It could be his DNA and fingerprints, but he may not have anything to do with the crime at all. So these are circumstantial evidence. They get stronger and stronger. It kind of begins to border on physical evidence. And we know what DNA is. We won't have to go in all of that. Physical evidence that proves the Bible is true. And this gets to be kind of fun. We look at some things here. Deuteronomy 11, 29, blessings and curses. And we have Joshua 8, 30 to 35, the altar of uncut stones. And John 4, 5, and 6, the Samaritan woman at the well. And what you see here is the valley that the Israelites entered as they went into the promised land. And what you see at in the depth of the valley is Shechem. To the left, in the south, is Mount Gerizim, and that was what the Lord proclaimed the blessings. And to the north is Mount Ebal, and that's he proclaimed the curses. We'll take a look at some of this stuff. And the first is Jacob's well. You know that Jacob's well still exists? Many people don't know it. Jacob's well is a deep well. It was hewn in solid rock that has been associated with Jewish religion for millennia and Christian religion for more than 2,000 years. It's situated in a short distance from the archaeological site of Tel Blata. Tel is just a word for a mound where archaeological evidence might be. If suddenly Mansfield just stopped, it became a ghost town, over time it would kind of collapse on itself, and windblown sediment and other kind of things would make a mound. And that's what they call a tel. And this Tel Blata, it's thought to be the site of Shechem. The well currently lies within a complex of, it's an Eastern Orthodox monastery in the city of Nablus in the West Bank. And where is it? Well, this laser isn't showing so great right now, but it's right about in the middle to the left of what you see at the top there is the Sea of Galilee, at the bottom the Dead Sea, and Shechem is just about halfway up, a little bit to the west of the Jordan River. I have to hold that up a little higher, I guess. And there's just another example where Shechem is. You can see it. It's got a Mount Ebal to the left and Mount Gerizim to the right, and there's Jericho. We're going to take a look at that in a little bit, too. I went too far. Here is the well. And this is from a collection at the Library of Congress, and it's somewhere between 1900 to 1920. Men were standing around the well. The lady was carrying the water. She's always doing the work, I guess. She was carrying the water from the well. And this picture was about 1928, and it too is in the same collection. It was known that the well was about 79 feet deep and 3 feet wide, perhaps deeper if cleaned out, and we'll find that it was. And here's later a church was built over the wall. This is sometime before before 1940. And you can see a woman there getting water from the well. This is 1934, and this church is built over that well complex. Well, this is it today. It's at the Church of Fotina. Fotina means the luminous one. It's a Greek Orthodox church. And this is inside the church. There's the well. I'm leaning over it. And again, this is a 2013 photo, so it still exists. You can go there. You can see it. Now we've got physical evidence outside the Bible that demonstrates that the Bible, what the Bible is saying is true. Yes. And according to this fellow, Major Anderson, he found that, I won't read through all this, but the point is, the measurements he took in 1935, the depth of the well is about 135 feet. Well, the question that popped up into my mind when we looked at this before, because a few in our little class have examined this before, how did they dig that well? 135 feet, they didn't have any power tools. I won't go into, I think I figured it out. We talked about it in class. I think the Chinese had dug wells that deep, and I showed you how they did it, and I suspect the Israelites did it the same way. But one thing I know, they didn't use that. And I looked all around that truck from Jackson Well Services, and I couldn't find Dan sitting in there anywhere. And for those that you might not know, Dan used to work for Jackson Well Services, so I know they didn't have that. Here's another example, the Wailing Wall. It exists. It's there. It was the foundation for Herod's temple. The temple's gone, but this was just a fortification. It was a wall to support that temple. Let's see. And interesting thing is, it was started in Herod's rule sometime between 20 and 19 BC, but there was a considerable amount of construction done during the Hasmonean period. So even before that. So here again, we're getting evidence that it goes on back into antiquity. How about the Babylonian exile? This is pretty interesting when you get into this. You know, we all know about it. We've read about it and how the Israelites were taken to Babylonia, Nebuchadnezzar, and the story goes. And incidentally, that's one word I've come to despise. Story. And the reason is, it's an account. Yes, it has legitimate definition for an account, but when we say story today, we think of fairy tales, and that does a lot of damage to what we're trying to explain. And so I've kind of really pushed myself to remember to say account instead of story. Okay. On October 12th in 539, the Persian ruler Cyrus the great he conquered Babylonia. With brilliant military strategy, Cyrus managed to conquer the unconquerable, as it was said that Babylonians' walls could not be penetrated, a true statement. What did he do? This was known as the Battle of Opus. In a military engagement, Cyrus knew that they could never break the walls. So he waited until the Babylonians had a national feast where they would attack unsuspectingly. There was an entrance into the Babylon through the Euphrates River, where someone could hold their breath and swim under this entrance into the city of Babylon, but it was virtually impossible. The depth of the wall was just too thick. Cyrus had his men divert the river, until the water was only hip deep. Cyrus took control of the city with virtually no fight. Babylon then came under the control of the Persian Empire. That's the Cliff Notes version, but that's what happened. Cyrus the Great, he was considered to be a tolerant ruler. He allowed different cultures within their empire to keep their religions. The Greeks called him the lawgiver. The Jews called him the anointed of the Lord. He allowed over 40,000 Israelites to turn back to Palestine. And you see references in the Bible. These are all verses of the Bible. We won't go through them, but it would take quite a while to go through all those. But this is where we see Cyrus referenced in the Bible. And here's outside the Bible. This is known as the Cyrus Cylinder, and it's in the British Museum. It's in cuneiform. It's baked clay. It's about 3.9 inches in diameter and about 8 to 9 inches long. And it was created in 593 or 539 to 538 BC. and it was discovered in Babylon in 1879. What's on it? Well, go back here. It describes just what I told you about Cyrus's victory in Babylon and how it occurred. So we've got evidence outside the Bible that supports the Bible. We've got other of these cylinders around. This is called the Taylor Prism because he's the guy that discovered it. He discovered it in Nivea. And this is about this fella here. Sennacherib's prism is also called that. But on that prism, it describes what happened. The prism contains columns of text in which Assyrian king, I wish he had an easier name, Sennacherib. Incidentally, you know what that word means? It means sin replaces the brothers. That's kind of striking. Sennacherib describes his triumphs. He kind of spins this around a little bit different, but it's still the same evidence. On the column, he recounts how the campaign against Judah, presenting a version of his events, narrated in 2 Kings 18 to 19, like the Bible, a certain part of it. But he spins it a little bit. He said that he left Judah with King Hezekiah, like a bird in a cage. Well, that's not what happened. That was the loser's version. What really happened, you know the story, the 185,000 angels came and swept away that fella, Sennacherib's army. That's what really happened, in the Bible tells us. But the point is, it's on this column here, right there. But it's in cuneiform. You have to know how to read that. Outside the Bible, it's proof. Here it is. Like I said, it's known as the Taylor's Prism. And it tells this whole story, but it's from a different side. And you can go see some of these prisms. What I just described is at the Oriental Institute in the University of Chicago, so put that on your bucket list. And we have the Jerusalem prism. It's another set of evidence. These are all evidence outside the Bible. What else do we have? Well, we have bulla, and we have a lot of bulla. And bulla are, they're seals, and they were made of clay, and they were baked, and they would use them to seal their messages, often in a scroll form, and there might be more than one on one scroll, but there's a ton of them, and it seems like they find new ones almost every month. There's a ton of archaeology going on in Israel. And here's more examples. The one with the, up there in the upper left corner, it's got, looks like a bee. That's from Ephesus. And Ephesus was, it used the bee as part of its identification. And like I say, we've got Gedaliah, Jeremiah, that was his scribe. These are all evidence outside the Bible that the Bible is true. And what about Herod the Great? He dies in Jericho. Remember I said we're going to take a look at Jericho. Somewhere around 4 B.C., and it's believed that he died of chronic kidney disease. Well, he had built a fortress in Jericho, and it's Herod's tomb. And for centuries, they were trying to find Herod's tomb, and they couldn't. It wasn't found. But in 2007, it was discovered by Hud Netzer. It was his career searching for this, and he found it in what's called the Fortress of Herodium, and there it is. Here's a artist depiction of what that fortress looked like. If you notice, about right in the middle, towards the right, you'll see a circle in there. And that's called a frigidarium. And a frigidarium was something they built because Jericho is very hot, especially in the summertime. It was cool water instead of a hot water. And here's the tomb, Herod the Great. They discovered it. You can go there. You can see it. That's just amazing. And there is an overshot, or aerial shot, of what they excavated. And there you see that frigidarium there. There's an aerial shot of the whole Herodium. And there's an up-close photo of that frigidarium. That's what they used to keep cool, at least it was built for Herod to stay cool. And here's some kids playing around on it. I wonder if they really knew what that really represented and what the history of this was. Well, what else do we have? Like I said, we've got the bull, but we've got tons of coins that were issued for at different times. Each time a new king came, they really didn't have calendars at that point, and they measured their time by events. And when a new king came into power, well, that would start a new time. And you see that when we read it in the Bible, such and such happened after king did something. And that's how they measured their time. But each time they did it, they made coins. And this is Herod the Great. It was minted in Samaria. Here's one that's of particular interest to me. It's really kind of what started me in getting interested in this. And it is the Via Egnatia. And that was a road. You see that red line that goes across the top there. It goes apart across what is now known as Greece. It was built by the Romans under the guidance of a guy by the name of Gaius Ignatius. And it was a highway. And it connected by sea to Brindisi there on the Italian boot. You'll see that. A little side story on Brindisi, because it kind of fits into some of the nastiness that the Romans did. You know, may know the story of Spartacus. It happened about 75 years before Christ was born. Spartacus was a gladiator. He was a slave, but he was a gladiator. He started a revolt in Rome, and it grew to be about 30,000 people. Long story short, he escaped Rome with his legion of 30,000 slaves, and they went to Brindisi there. I wish this is it. I could get that laser to work, but there at the boot. There was a big battle that occurred and went on for about 2 years. And finally, the Romans had enough, and there was, I can't remember his name right now, but he was the wealthiest guy in Rome. He was in the Senate, and he volunteered to take 40,000 Romans down to Brindisi, and he wiped them out. He really did away with them. But the Romans were so vindictive and so dedicated to controlling, and they didn't want this rise to happen. If you see on the boot there, that yellow line, that is the Via Appia, the way that went up to Rome. Well, when they defeated those Spartacus slaves, they crucified 6,000 men along that road. Can you imagine going down to Columbus in 70 and seeing 6,000 men on being crucified? It would be horrendous. And one of the things you don't really gather is what the odor would have been like. It would have been horrible. Anyhow, that's just a little side there that I just thought people ought to know, because why that punishment of crucifixion was widely known and widely feared. But anyhow, let's go back to Via Egnatia. This is Via Egnatia. It goes from a little city down there. You see, it used to be Neapolis, but it's Tavola, and it's in the background. But Paul and Silas and Luke walked on that road. And that just affected me somehow. I go, man, what would that be like to just walk on that road and think that Paul and Silas and Luke walked on that road? And here's another example of that Egnatia road, Via Egnatia. It's still there. And that just amazes me. Like I said, it just had something that made me think a lot. What about Paul? Paul baptizes Lydia and her household. Remember, they arrived in Neapolis. They walked to Philippi, which is a little bit north of the seaport there of Neapolis. And he baptized, won't get into the whole story, but he baptized Lydia and her family, and he baptized her in this river, little river right below Philippi. Ganges River outside. It's still there. You can go there. And when you see these things and you see them, that they physically exist, and know that you can put your hand in that water, nothing holy about it. It just connects us with the account. What about Paul? You know what happened to Paul? He was beaten in Rome, or in Philippi, after they were there. And take a look here. This is a little side thing again, too. Sometimes, well, that's what the Bible tells us to learn in Isaiah. Precept upon precept, line upon line, here a little and there a little. It's a little bit of here and there and little there, and here a little and there a little. It helps you connect. Paul was beaten by this man here, but his name, they called these guys lictors. And most of them were former centurions. That meant that they ruled over 100 soldiers. And most of them were pretty, I imagine, pretty hefty fellas to hold that position. But what did they use? They used this thing called posies, and it symbolizes power and jurisdiction. And what it was 9 rods wrapped in leather, and it included that axe. It had all the tools he needed to administer whatever crime some magistrate said somebody had done, including beheading. And that those straps, well, you could use them to tie somebody to a wagon, and you could beat them. But that makes me think about Paul. Again, we get this circumstantial evidence with him. What did he say? He was beaten 5 times, 40 lashes minus 1. 5 times this happened to Paul. Would you be willing to go through that for something you didn't know, something you didn't believe? About the 4th time, I think, man, I don't want to do this anymore. And totally, that was 195 lashes. But it fits with both. This fits in circumstantial evidence. Paul, it was like evidence of the tomb. It was empty. Paul and the guy and the many that died, eventually Paul was killed. He was, tradition says, beheaded in Rome. Posies is kind of interesting, though. We see it everywhere. And if you look at the arm of the statue of Lincoln there, those are posies. Why? Because it stood for justice and power. And we see it all over in our country. This is our capital. Right behind President Trump there, to his left, you see the bronze. And to the right, you see the bronze. They're all, that symbol's everywhere. We see it in letterhead. This is for the United States courts. And we even see it on our money. This is called the Mercury Dime. It's on the back of it. That's just something that, when you see that, you're going to think of Paul, and you're going to think of Paul in Philippi getting that beating. And then we go back to Paul here for a minute. So, where's Philippi? Well, this is a map of what Philippi looked like in the time of Paul, and if you see that red block right there, that's the traditional place of the prison. But you can go to Philippi. This is Philippi. It's the ruins of Philippi. That Via Ignatia is now a highway that runs through the northern part of it. And I can't show up to you, but up on the right up on the top there towards the center, that's where the forum was. That's where Paul was beaten with the rods. And this is some of the ruins of Philippi, but you can go there. Again, we've got physical evidence now that connects with the story of Paul in Acts. And when they had laid many straight stripes on them, they were thrown into the prison. Commanding jailer to keep them securely. Having received such a charge, he put them into the inner prison and fastened their feet in the stocks. And you know the story. What happened? There was an earthquake, and the stocks in the jail was opened. That's the site that housed Paul and Silas. It's you can see it, you can touch it, you can go in there if you want. Jesus heals a blind man, then tells him to go to the pool of Siloam. Now don't confuse that with the pool of Bethesda. With the guy wanting to get in, and he can't get in because he's crippled. But this is the blind man. He goes to the pool of Siloam. This was in March 2005. They're doing excavations there on the left, and they think they found the Pool of Siloam. In July, a few months later, they find the steps, and they find the Pool of Siloam. They'd hunted for it for 100 years, and they found it. Hey, you can go there. That's where Jesus told the guy to go to wash. Well, the water in the Pool of Siloam in Jerusalem was regarded as sacred. This is an addition to what Jesus said to go wash there. According to early rabbinic tradition, during the celebration of the Feast of the Tabernacle, water was drawn from the pool in a golden vessel and taken to the temple. So it had a long history also prior to Jesus telling them to go to the pool to wash. Here's another one, and we're going to have a little bit of a history lesson here. Step back for a minute. This is Julius Caesar crossing the Rubicon, and long story short on this is Julius Caesar was a very powerful general, and he had a huge army in Gaul, which is now we call France. He had enough power, he had enough support, and there was a whole lot of political problems in Rome. He decided to return after 20 years, and he crossed the Rubicon. That was one of those things that we said you can never turn back. The issue was the generals could come back to Rome, but they weren't allowed to bring their legions with them. And they had a word for it. It was called imperium. But Caesar knew that he was going to what he was going to do. He took over Rome. Long story short, and he ruled for 4.5 years. It didn't end so well for him. You know what happened? Brutus stabbed him, and so did everyone in the Senate stab him, so they could say that it wasn't just Brutus. And that's where we get the beware the Ides of March. And after Julius Caesar, these two guys kind of got into the battle. The one on your left is Octavius. He was later Augustus. The one on the right was Marcus Antonius. We know him in the English as Mark Antony. And they juggled for power. Ultimately, they got into a number of fights. And, Mark Antony was married to Octavius' sister, but Mark Antony ended up with Cleopatra. Yes, that Cleopatra down in Egypt. And they ended up at this battle. And let's see, I'm going to point it up over here because it doesn't show over there very well. It's called the Battle of Actium. It occurred right there. And it's very important. It's very important to us right now because it fits into evidence. And what did we see? Well, I threw this up here just to see what was going on here. Cleopatra's down in Alexandria. Rome at that time really depended on Egypt. They needed Egypt for grain. And they had lots of vessels bringing grain into Rome. That's what Paul went to Rome in his fourth, what we call, missionary trip. That's what he rode in, was one of the grain ships. But the Battle of Actium, you can see it up there. And this is something, what happened here. You see the red and the blue. The red being Octavian. This was the last battle. Eventually, Octavian won. He defeated Mark Antony there. But what happened? Joseph Flavius, he was an historian. He was a Jew, but he worked for the Romans. And good for us, because Hebrews didn't record things. They recorded it more to their religion than we would do in history. But Flavius did that for the Romans. And he describes an earthquake that occurred in Judah during the Battle of Actium. Why is that important? Because we know the date of the Battle of Actium. The earth trembled and many animals and more than 30,000 people perished in Judea. That's what Flavius wrote. And now we're going to look at something called the Christ Quake. And in Matthew 27:50-51, and Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. Then behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth quaked, and the rocks were split. That's what happened at Jesus' crucifixion. To analyze earthquake activity in the region geologists studied three cores from the beach of Engedi Spa, and it's adjacent to the Dead Sea. It's down on the lower left-hand corner. You can see a little bit of red there. This is what they found. When you look at the cores, and they examine what they call varves, it's the different layers, and they are annual layers of deposition, and that's particularly important on the Engedi Spa there, because the Dead Sea rises and evaporates at a pretty regular rate, so they're able to really calculate sediment collection, or the process of sedimentation, pretty accurately. And looking at these, they see that there were two major earthquakes. A widespread earthquake that occurred in 31 BC. Well, what happened in 31 BC? That was the Battle of Actium that I just told you about. We can mark it on this core sample real close. It's right there. It's very big. There was another seismic event that occurred sometime, they said, between 26 and 36 AD. The reason they put the 26 to 36 AD is because we got a little calendar problem. It goes back to our Gregorian calendar. In 1582, they discovered that even right now with our calendar, we're off a few seconds. And we're real close on our year. But it built up over time, and they realized that our calendars were shifting. And that would mean that, hey, December might fall in what's now summertime because it wasn't exactly accurate. So they adjusted that calendar. So that's why they're saying between 27 and 36 AD. What that did was, we think of our calendars as a number line, but it's not a number line. There's no zero. We're not going minus 1, 0, 1. There's no zero there. So it makes it a little bit different. It's just a way of counting. If I'm counting 5 apples, I don't start out with 0. I start 1 apple, 2 apple. Somebody eats my apples, he ate 1 apple, 2 apples. So there's no zero. And that makes it a little bit difficult to really explain. So what we know now is Jesus was born sometime between minus 6 B.C. and 4 B.C. So that's why they're saying that that earthquake occurred between 26 and 36 A.D. Well, what do we know happened? I just showed you. It was called the Christ quake, and the earthquake that Christ's crucifixion. That's pretty doggone hard facts there. It's hard to deny that. Let's look at prophecy. What can apologetics do with prophecy? Well, if we look at Zechariah 4:14, and in that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall be split into from east to west. Remember that. And this is just a little topography map of Jerusalem. You can see the Mount of Olives on the right, a much higher elevation, going down the Kidron Valley, up to the temple, and then on over to Herod's palace. Something called the Seven Arches Hotel. It was originally constructed, it was called the International Continental Hotel of Jerusalem. And it was built in the early 60s, 1960s, by the country of Jordan. That's before the 1967 Six Days War, when afterwards Israel took claim of that land. It's now called the Seven Arches Hotel. And you can see it, it's hard to tell a little bit, but you can see it right here. They originally wanted to build it up here, but during their early phases of construction, they found something. Well, that's looking downward from Mount Olive into the city of Jerusalem and the temple. And again, there's a little closer up to the Seven Arches Hotel. You can see that. See all that stuff? It looks like dirt all around it, stones and stuff. Those are graves. And Mount of Olives has been a graveyard for 3,000 years. And that's what you see there. They're gravestones and so forth. But remember, I tell you, remember that earthquake? And Jeremiah said from east to west, during the construction of that hotel, which they wanted to put up on top of the Mount of Olives, they ran into that. They found an earthquake fault. So they couldn't construct it there. They had to move it down. We've got that evidence. There is an earthquake fault right where Zedekiah predicted. It's pretty amazing. What's the odds of George Washington saying in, 1787, he died in 1799, that I've got one foot in Pennsylvania and another foot into what's going to be called Ohio. It's not created yet, but right here there's going to be a fault. That's only 200 years. That prediction, that prophecy was more than 2,000 years. So it's just pretty amazing when you start thinking about these things. But that's that hotel. You can go there. It runs about $500 a night. Pretty nice hotel. Come on here. And just another shot. And another one. Again, you can just see the hill. I was just reminding you that they wanted to put that hotel up on the top. And Zechariah, it said his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives in 14:4. And he'll step over and there'll be this breakage. Well, what's interesting is go on to Zechariah 14:5. He says that that's the valley created by this rift that Jews will escape from Jerusalem and Jesus will stand protecting them for the army chasing them. So I'm talking about the Jews that accepted Christ. Numbers. The sons of Elab were Daniel. I won't go through all this, but this has to do with, I'm getting long here. The sons of Korah, okay? This is what happened a year ago March in Kenya. That opened up in one day, and it's a rift. And you can see it on the left. It extends from quite a ways up through Kenya. And there it is close up. Can that rift happen? Could that rift have happened in Israel with the sons of Korah? Well, let's take a look. That's called the Great Eastern Rift, or sometimes the Great African Rift. It extends up through Eastern Africa. It goes on into Saudi Arabia. You see Yemen there. But guess what? It extends the whole way up through Israel, that rift. Kind of makes you shiver a little bit. It's just astounding that the information that's available in apologetics to help us understand. Christians who know why they believe, what they believe, and who can defend their beliefs are able to do two things, as I said earlier, which are the very context and purpose of 1 Peter 3:15. First, this is how we sanctify Christ in our heart, strengthen our own faith, and confidence. Second, giving a defense and a reason for the hope that is in us and how we extend that same hope to those who are asking. Embracing a value for apologetics empowers us to love God with our mind as well as our heart, soul, and strength, as I said. The goal in most conflicts is to destroy your opponent. The goal in apologetics is to win your opponent.